It's time to turn to the WUKY Sports page with your host, Keith Elkins, revealing conversations and stories you thought you knew from prominent Kentucky sports figures. Now, here once again is Keith Elkins.
Doug Flynn is with us today. He's a Lexington native, graduate of Bryan Station High School, where he had a great sports career, played basketball at the University of Kentucky for a year, and then went on to an 11-year career in Major League Baseball. And he's been in broadcasting for the Cincinnati Reds, the University of Kentucky, and the SEC Network. He's the host of Kentucky Life on Kentucky Educational Television, and he's found time over the years to give a lot back to his hometown and his home state with various charitable causes as well. Doug, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Keith. Always a pleasure to do anything with you, pal.
Well, I appreciate that. Before we get into our conversation, I wanted to call your attention to an anniversary. It was 40 years ago, almost to the day, that Doug Flynn of the New York Mets was named National League Player of the Week after going 14 for 31 in a big week for you. And, of course, you were known for the glove. You won a gold glove that same year. But that must have been quite a week.
Yeah, quite a year for me, really, in that one week. Yeah, that was kind of cool, you know, somehow found a way to start hitting some extra base hits. And one of the good things about playing in New York at that time, I was playing for Joe Torre, and Joe always gave me a chance to perform. You know, he didn't pinch hit for me very much. He just stuck me in the lineup and let me go. And even though our team wasn't playing real well, I was very blessed to have an opportunity just to play for Joe.
You know, I was going to ask you about Joe Torre in a few minutes, but let me go ahead and bring that up since you did. At the time, now, of course, everyone knows Joe Torre is a Hall of Fame manager and his long tenure with the Yankees, but he was just getting started as a manager at that time. In fact, I guess had just recently retired or maybe even was still playing when you joined the Mets. Wasn't that the case at the time?
Yeah, he actually was player manager when I came over there in 77. And he only did it for the 1 year, and then he took over managing the ball club. And, you know, the club was going through so many changes at that time. They were really dismantling that really good team they had from 69 and 73. A lot of guys were being traded or moving on, retiring. And Joe took over a team of a bunch of young kids that really had come over either through trades or they developed in the minor leagues. And I've told people, if you cannot play for Joe Torre, then you can't play. He was an excellent player, most valuable player in the league, could really hit. And he just had a way of communicating with, you know, front office as well as with the players. And he went to Atlanta after he left us and was successful. They finished first, second, and second, but they ended up firing him. And then he, of course, goes to New York and has that great run of World Series with those teams. So, and now working in the commissioner's office. So I had a chance to talk with him not too long ago, I guess. And it's always good to try to stay in touch with people that really helped me with my career.
And you mentioned Joe Torre being able to communicate both with players in the front office and being able to just survive as Yankees manager for as long as he did in the era that he did, much less continue to win. They certainly had to have all those skills at his disposal during that era.
Well, it takes a special person to have to deal with front office. And when you have as big a person as George Steinbrenner, who certainly liked the attention himself, and then was down in the locker room and wanted to feel like that he could pull all the strings, it took a special guy. I mean, we saw all the ones like Yogi and Billy Martin and others who were there for off and on for several years who had a love-hate relationship. Joe was always so easygoing and, you know, being from New York, he could handle pretty much anything that was thrown his way while playing in New York.
Let me ask you about the current baseball season, such as it is. They are still playing, except for the Cardinals, who are still shut down after playing five games this season. But baseball is being played, although it's a 60-game season, an empty ballpark, some new rules. How much are you enjoying or not this 2020 baseball season?
Oh, that's a loaded question right there, Keith. I try to keep up. I'm not doing any broadcasts anymore with the Reds. They kind of went in a different direction and let a few of us retire early. But I do keep up because I am a Reds fan, and I want to see how well that they can do. I really expected them to get out of the gate a little bit quicker this year, and it hasn't been because of the lack of starting pitching. It has been outstanding. But the offense that they thought was going to be there certainly is not. And then you throw in a few injuries like the one to Moustakas, who when he was in the lineup, the Reds were winning every game. And then now he's on the injured list. But it's different watching the game. And I have to admit, I'm sure it's different playing the game because so many players, you play on adrenaline and you play on emotion. And when you've got that many people in there either pulling for you or against you, it can really drive you to – you know, played really well. Although I've been very impressed with the effort that I've seen from most of the players that I've had an opportunity to watch over the last couple of weeks. It's just different, Keith. And, you know, I'm glad that they started playing for the simple reason that I think if they did not, then one of the other pro sports, either basketball or football, would have picked up a lot of fans from baseball that were turned off in 1994. Some of them never came back. And I think there's a group out there now that probably if something like that happened would not be coming back as fans. I'm not a fan of how they are structuring the game around all these different formulas like launch angle and spin ratio and all that kind of junk. Mm-hmm. You know, for me, it'd be nice to see them get back to, all right, what's it going to take to win a ball game? I don't care how hard you throw or what kind of launch angle and stuff you have. Can you win games? And so right now, we've seen the Reds, who really struggled to win ball games, you know, not hitting with runners in scoring position, not moving runners over. It's a different ball game. And I'm sure the guys that played way before me, when they saw us play, were thinking, good Lord, I can't watch that mess.
Yeah. Well, we're recording on August the 11th, so we want to make that qualifier because who knows, if you're listening to this on, say, August the 18th, the whole thing may have been shut down, or maybe the Cardinals have been eliminated because they haven't been able to play, or any number of things can happen. We just have to watch the news day to day. But that's the situation up to now. And go ahead.
I don't mean to interrupt, but I feel bad for those Cardinals guys and the other teams that have had to shut her down because they went through spring training, they came back, they worked, you know, got themselves ready to go. It's going to be interesting to see what baseball decides to do if they don't close down, how they're going to make up all those games. And we've heard 7-inning doubleheaders. So a lot of different ways that they can do it. But, yeah, I feel for those guys who are not being able to play at all right now because, one, they're away from their families, and they're still not performing and getting an opportunity to go out and work. You know, if you're a professional athlete or an entertainer, you've got – a lot of us have issues that getting on that ball field or on that stage would help eliminate. There's something in our DNA that, you know, I don't say we're psychos or crazy people, but there's a thirst for wanting to perform and wanting to compete. And when you take that away – there's a lot of carryover for that even goes back to the home and the family and stuff. So I really feel for the guys that aren't getting a chance to do that right now.
Yeah, and the Cardinals are in a situation, at least at the time that we're talking, they would have to play 55 games in something like 45 days, which is sounds like impossible even with the 7-inning games on the doubleheader. So we'll just have to wait and see what happens, as we're having to wait and see what happens in so many things in our life and society right now. You mentioned the Reds, and this was a year in which Reds fans understandably were pretty excited about the way things were shaping up during the regular spring training back in March. The support here in Lexington and Kentucky, the eastern part of the state, goes back such a long way for the Reds. The fans are ready to get excited, and whether that has shown up in big numbers in attendance at the ballpark in the last few years, the fans are still, I get the sense anyway, they're still out there, they're still excited. They may not be at the ballpark in big numbers, but there's still a huge support factor for that team here in the Lexington area and Kentucky in general, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely correct. I mean, people still, when I'm out, come up and talk to me about the Reds, and a lot of people say, I'm not a fan anymore. Well, they're closet fans then because they're listening to the radio or sneaking a peek on television. And there were and are a lot of fans that are in this area. And what they're looking for is, you know, just a team that's going to entertain them and compete and play hard. The biggest gripe I get is not that they lose so much, it's just how they lose. And I think they have a very valid argument. But, you know, with this team this season, Joey Votto's hitting under 200. Suarez is hitting 130. Senzel's off to a rough start. The bullpen is absolutely brutal right now. They find one person to come in and shut anybody down. And, you know, with all the moving around that David Bell does with his team, it could create some issues because you rarely see back-to-back starting lineups of that are the same. You rarely see a guy who maybe in the same position out in the bullpen. They're kind of trying to move them around, and it may be because they just haven't been able to get anybody to be effective. So I know one thing. When I knew I went to the ballpark and I was going to be hitting in a certain place and playing in the lineup, I was a lot more relaxed than going to the ballpark and not knowing if you're going to play, when you're going to play. And there's just so many moving parts that are going on. I was talking with Johnny Bench a couple weeks ago. He said, did you see how many coaches were in the dugout? And he said, I counted 12.
Wow.
I thought, well, you know, that might be right because they got a hitting coach, an assistant, a pitcher coach, an assistant, and then they got a stat guy and then an infield guy, outfield guy, base running guy. Just, you know, got to check the monitor to see if it's, you know, if it's going to be replay or not. So it's a good time to be in baseball because they're hiring an awful lot of people. Yeah. But good night, that's a busy dugout going on during the ball game. And, you know, sometimes you're going to need a little space. So, this whole different philosophy with the game now than there was back in the day.
Well, let me go back in the day now and actually pre-baseball and talk a little bit about your basketball accomplishments. You were at the University of Kentucky. Now, was that the 69-70 year when you were at UK? Tell me about your basketball experience there.
Well, one of the coolest years of my life, actually. No scholarship offers coming out of high school, and then get a phone call because of a good friend of mine named Rick Derrickson had committed to go to the University of Kentucky, ended up signing a contract with the Cleveland Indians, and had one of the best arms I ever saw, one of the best people I ever knew, and, you know, because of arm injuries, did not make it to the major league, but he certainly physically could have been there. So I get a chance to go to UK and play, and it's really neat, but if I wasn't going to work out in basketball, then supposedly I was to get a baseball scholarship. And the year playing basketball was so fun because the varsity was ranked number one in the nation with, you know, Dan Issel and Mike Pratt and Larry Steele and just so many good players on that team. Cameron Mills likes to tease me that I'm so old that I played with his dad. And, right.
Yeah, I watched his dad play when I was a student, so yeah, I know.
And then every day going out there, we scrimmage an hour with the number one team in the nation, and at 5'8 and 150 pounds, I was not very imposing, but it really taught me how to compete at a higher level because, as you know, when you're a freshman playing against seniors, they're not going to take it easy on you. They're going to beat the tar out of you, which was really good. But they all were such good people. That year, watching them play and how they went about their business, and then being with guys like Larry Stamper and Jim Andrews, who's still, you know, such a dear friend, it was just an outstanding year because when you went on the road, they had a full gymnasium. So every night you went out to perform, you were playing in front of a full house because everybody got there early and they wanted to see the number one team in the nation obviously play. So great, great experience, great growing up experience. I'll always be very thankful to the folks at UK that allowed me to be there. The baseball didn't go too good. I only got 9 at-bats as a freshman. And then after that year, moved on down to a junior college where I didn't play any sports, but was able to get my schooling in and started maturing a little bit. And then got an opportunity to go to a tryout camp. And at that tryout camp, that's where the Reds said, what would it take for you to be a pro ball player? And I said, Coke and a hot dog. And, the rest, you know, as they say, is history.
Yeah. That tryout camp was overseen by Chet Montgomery, who oversaw a lot of tryout camps. I can't imagine the number of players he must have observed over the years in running those tryout camps. But that was where it began for you, and it wasn't like you were, as I recall, fully equipped to go to the tryout camp. But you found enough equipment to get out there and perform and made a good impression, and that's where the pro career began, right?
Yeah, I had some buddies that woke me up, and we'd been out the night before over to Richmond to see the Exiles play. And they got up the next morning and said, we're all going to try out for the Cincinnati Reds. And I went, all right, let's go. So we headed over to the ballpark, and thank goodness one of the guys there had a glove and some spikes. Tim Williams was his name, and he ran Somerset Foods for a long time. And Tim says, you know, you go first. He had an A2000 Wilson. All of my stuff was up here in Lexington, and this was down in Somerset, Kentucky. So I went and tried out, and Mr. Montgomery came up and said, you're not serious about this, are you? I guess because I had on a tank top and a pair of cutoff shorts, and I think I had a headband, if I remember correctly. Everybody there was in baseball uniforms and, you know, looking good. I said, well, you know, sir, I said, I guess I'm not. Those guys sort of dared me to do this. And he said, what if I told you I thought you had a little talent? And I said, well, I think you're probably messing with me. He said, no, serious, I'd like to see you again. Could you have a baseball uniform? Yes, sir. I'd like to see you in 2 weeks down in Frankfort, Kentucky. Yes, sir. So I show up, and all you do at a trial camp, you get to run the 60-yard dash, you get to take five swings, and then take a round of infield. So we did the same thing there in Frankfort, and I don't hear anything for 2 weeks. And then I get a phone call that says, Doug, this is Mr. Montgomery. I'd like for you to come up to Cincinnati, to Riverfront Stadium. We're going to have 90 guys there from four different states. So I go up, take another round of infield on AstroTurf, which I thought was really cool. Yeah. I'd never been on it before. And so we five swings, round of infield. He walks up to me afterwards. He says, you know, I want to see you one more time. So they come back to Lexington out at Southland Park. They worked me out by myself, hit me ground balls, throw BP to me. And that's when he said, what would it take for you to be a pro ball player? And I got, I think $2,500 was my signing bonus. I went away to rookie league ball where they pay you $500 a month and got moved up to class A ball where they pay you $500 a month because that was the minimum salary then. And Russ Nixon came into my life as my manager and later a dear friend, and he really got behind me. He liked the way that I played defense. Even though after my first year I was ready to come home, and I said, Russ, you know, I can go back. I've got a chance to go play basketball in college for 4 years for Doug Hines down in Tennessee, or 3 years. And he said, you know what, Doug? He said, I'd stick around one more year. And I said, why? He says, your defense is going to carry you a long way. If you can just get a little bit of offense, he says, I just think you got a chance. And because of that, I stayed. And the next year went to AA and got MVP of the team and made the All-Star team. The next year, AAA, made the MVP of the team. And then 75 went to spring training with really no chance. I mean, where am I going to play? They had everything they needed on that ball club.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. That had such a great spring that Sparky kept me in. You know, that's it. It's hard to get there. It's harder to stay. But after you get 2 or 3 years under your belt, it certainly makes it a whole lot easier. But how cool was it to break in with the Big Red Machine and back-to-back world championships and just be around guys that were probably the smartest baseball players I'd ever seen? Yeah. People say on the field they might not have been, or Spark even said that. But on the field, when they got to the ballpark, it was nothing but baseball and business. And they took care of it about as good as anybody I was ever around.
Yeah, the Big Red Machine has really stood the test of time now because, hard as it is to believe, it's been, what, 45 years or so since they were at their peak, but they are still regarded as possibly the best team ever, maybe going back to the Yankees of the Babe Ruth era. The Reds of 75 and 76 would certainly be the best teams in our lifetimes, and you were part of that. And you mentioned making the team out of spring training in 1975. As you said, you'd had a great spring, so it wouldn't be, I guess, a shock to have made the roster. But at the same time, it's such a big moment for everybody. When and how did you learn that you were, in fact, going to be on the opening day roster?
Well, I think when you go to spring training, I knew that Joe Morgan and Dave Concepcion, Davey would be late. He always had visa problems, and I was given that information. But I saw it, too, because 74, I actually went down to the big league camp, and I was only up for 2 weeks, and they sent me out. They would bring me back to play games, but they didn't have to pay us back then, so they sent us back to the minor leagues, and they did that to a lot of players. That was just common practice. 75. But I also went to winter ball in 74 in Venezuela, and I got to play a little bit over there. So when I came to spring training in February, I was in pretty good shape and had a lot of ball in my belt. And I was in the lineup, and I started off really well. And I think I was doing so good that it sort of scared Sparky that they might have to keep me. So they just left me in the lineup, really, I think, hoping that I'd play my way out of it. But I didn't. I ended up going 32 for 90. and which is a lot of at bats. And we're playing the Tigers about 3 days before we break camp. I still have heard nothing from anybody if I'm going to make the team or not. I'm assuming I am not, because they already had the positions that I was trying to do, like a utility player. Daryl Chaney was there, a good player. And I'm thinking, well, all right, they're just going to keep me for the whole spring. This is cool. I get big league meal money, so I like that.
Yeah.
And we're playing the Tigers, and Steve Hamilton was down at spring training with the Tigers. And for people that don't know, Steve was a great player with the Yankees, played in the NBA, athletic director at Morehead State here in our great Commonwealth. And Steve walked up to me, and I knew him, of course, and he said, "Dougie, way to go, man. You've made the club." And I said, "Steve, Sparky hasn't said anything to me." He said, "Oh, Sparky won't tell you." He said, "But he told me." And he said, "Congratulations." He says, "Man, you got to call your dad tonight. When you do, tell him I said, hey."
Well, how about that? So you actually found out from somebody with another organization, even though it was somebody you'd known for a long time. How about that? It is such a great moment for every player, isn't it? I've asked some guys over the years, they're former major leaguers, and nobody forgets that moment, regardless of circumstances, and there are a lot of different circumstances, it seems.
Well, and, you know, we open up at home, which Cincinnati did all the time, usually the first game, playing the Dodgers, and I got a great picture of me and Pete Rose, and Mom and Dad, of course, were up there, 55,000 people, and Pete and I are leaning over this little fence that was at the dugouts at Riverfront. And I'll never forget. He says, "You know what?" I said, "It's going to be the first game you haven't played in a long time." But he was wrong, because in the 10th inning of a tie ball game, I went in and got the bunt, my first at bat. So I had got a sacrifice bunt. We won the game in 10 innings. So, yeah, and probably the most important at bat of my career, because I know if I don't get it down, Sparky's sending me back to the minor league. So that was, it was pretty cool. Then, I mean, those years went by so quick. And like when you're winning, and I've got so many dear friends this year, as you mentioned, Keith, our 45th year since we won, I was going to try to get the Big Red Machine together and talk with the Reds. And we've lost three players off of the team. And one of the reasons that I wanted to do it is because every year, you know, guys get older and not as healthy. And the theme was going to be, we're doing it at 45 in case we don't make 50.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So then, of course, everything been sort of shut down. We'll go back to work on it again next year, and hopefully we'll do it and tie it in when Marty gets inducted into the Reds Hall of Fame, mm-hmm. and a lot of us can be right there with him.
Was there now you made the roster, of course, so that's their way of you're part of the team. You're expected to perform in the role that they had in mind for you. But even so, when you're new to any team, no matter how well you know the people beforehand, there's got to be a time when you feel like you've contributed and you've actually become a part of things. And that first at bat may have been more important than you thought it would be. But was there a particular game or stretch of games where you felt like, okay, I know I can contribute, and I know I belong here?
Yeah. You know, you remember all your firsts. I think we went on a road trip, and our record was like 19 wins and 20 losses in Montreal. Then we head back home to Cincinnati, and we're playing the Mets. Tom Seaver was on the mound, ironically, I guess.
Yeah.
And we ended up getting a lead, and somehow I got into the game. And that night I hit my first big league home run was a 3-run homer. And we went on to win 41 of the next 50. And it was just one of the most incredible runs. We had several 10-game win streaks in there. And I was getting a lot of playing time because they ended up moving Pete Rose into third base, putting George Foster in the left field. Well, if the game was pretty close and Pete had hit in the eighth or ninth inning, I was going into the game for defense at third base for Pete. And, you know, I remember making a couple of plays that, you know, a lot of folks won't remember. I do. And that way I knew, all right, I am contributing in some way. And even Johnny Bench to this day will tell you that the greatest thrill in his baseball career was walking into that locker room and seeing 25 guys are not going to make any headlines in the books that are all written about the Big Red Machine. Most of the guys you won't even know or have heard of, but knowing that 25 guys had some part in all of us getting a World Series ring. And, you know, it's still very special. It was a unique group of guys. And then after 75, shoot 76. We just rolled, man. I mean, it was just look out. And then, of course, the winter of 76, they got rid of Perez. They got rid of a bunch of us. I didn't go till later on the year, but they got rid of a lot of that big red machine. You know, we were guys that all got along well. We liked each other. We played hard for each other. And when you start breaking up that chemistry, you know, it plays such a big part in a ball club. And Marty Brindamore will say that the 90 team had better chemistry. I don't know. Maybe. And they were a good ball club. But we all knew our place. We all knew our parts. We knew what we had it took to win. And if you were going to be a utility player, then you were going to be the best one in baseball. If you were a pinch hitter, you were going to be the best one in baseball. So it was just, we all had our roles, and our grade eight was really good. But the rest of us, you know, we had a place on that team, and I'm very thankful for that.
Yeah, and you mentioned the chemistry, and with a team like that, I mean, these weren't just, you know, good players or a collection of good talent. These were guys that having Hall of Fame caliber careers all over the diamond as far as the starters were concerned. And you would think with that much talent that it would be hard to blend as a team and have that good chemistry. But that was just one of many things that made that really a remarkable stretch of baseball.
Well, you had four leaders on that team. You had Bench and Rose, Morgan and Perez. That was the four guys. And not many teams could say you had a Latin leader, a black leader, and white leader all in the same – that were the superstars of the ball club.
Mm-hmm.
And so anytime there were any issues, Tony would handle all the Latin stuff. He was so good for Davey and for Cesar and Bourbon. The black guys looked up to Joe. You know, Joe's 5'7" and weighs 155 pounds. But was a leader of that ball club because he was a great player. I mean, just a great player. And then the rest of us to Johnny and Pete. If we had any issues, we'd go to them. And the four of those guys would rag each other so much. They would be on each other unmercifully. But if somebody else tried to jump in there, the four of them would team up. And that's what they did as players. I mean, they didn't go the same way on the field after the game was over. But when they got to the ballpark, they each respected one another so much. And they knew what was going to make that team great was the harmony. And not only that, but in those days when everybody was growing sideburns and jacking up their stirrups on the team and long hair, the Reds had a policy, you know, no facial hair, keep your hair short. And because the four leaders on our team did that, there was no really issue for the rest of us to say, well, it's good enough for Johnny Bench and Pete Rose and Morgan and Perez. But we'll keep our hair short. We'll wear our uniform the way you're supposed to wear it. And that was never even an issue. So you just went to the ballpark, you worked hard, you played hard, and when the game was over with, then you came back. And, you know, the other team knew that too. But when they knew coming out on that field, they were in for nine innings of baseball, and there was never a lead that was safe enough with that team.
And, of course, as you mentioned, after 76, things began to gradually break up as far as the Big Red Machine was concerned. Your trade came on trade deadline. It used to be June 15th, 1977. Of course, Tom Seaver to the Reds and you and Pat Zachary, Steve Henderson, Dan Norman to the Mets. Did you have an idea that something was up? And then how did you and the others find out about it as far as the trade being completed?
Well, we knew something was up, but a lot of those names weren't even being brought up. There was an article in the Cincinnati paper said a few guys were untouchable, and I was one of them. And that meant that we were there, it looked like, for the duration.
Mm-hmm.
And then about 2 days later at the ballpark, we're playing, I want to say the Phillies or the Cardinals. I can't remember. I want to say the Phillies. And Pete was playing third and being very animated as he was talking which he talked all the time, but a little more so than normal. And the inning was over, and he came over and he sat down beside me, and he patted me on the leg and didn't say anything. And I said, "I'm going, Arnold." And he said, "Yeah."
Hmm.
I said, "Where am I going?" He said, "You're going to New York." And I went, "Wow, which one?" Because I'm thinking, if I'm going to New York, who are the middle infielders on the Yankees and the Mets that I might get a chance to play a little more?
Right.
Hmm. He said, "You're going to the Mets." And I said, "Wow, who for?" And he said, "Tom Seaver." And I sort of jokingly said, "Straight up?" And he said, "Not hardly." And sure enough, Dick Wagner comes in, gets me to sign a couple of pieces of paper, doesn't shake my hand, doesn't say good luck, nothing, just kind of throws a piece of paper down and says, you're now property of the New York Mets.
Wow.
So now I'm trying to find out, all right, I got to make my flights, I got to find out where am I going to stay, how am I getting to New York, and those are things that you just kind of had to do on your own back in those days. One of the good things they've done in baseball is they've really taken a lot of those kind of responsibilities out of the players' hands, and that's a good thing. But when I got to New York, you know, they still had a lot of the old guys left. Felix Mion, Buddy Harrelson, Jerry Kuzman, Grody, Matlack, Crane Pool. There was a lot of holdovers from, you know, their 73 team, their 69 World Championship team. So they were starting to rebuild and do a few different things. And Joe Torre was the manager. I'll tell you what. 77 was a tough year for me, though, because that was also the time that my sister had disappeared. And, you know, now I'm getting traded to New York, not a country boy, but, you know, Midwest boy going to New York. And there was a lot of stuff I was fighting that year. And so I'm just thankful that there was a lot of good people in New York who really kind of took me under their wing. Kuzman and Matlack being two that were just dear friends. And, of course, Joe Torre being the other. So, you know, it was – Cincinnati, a little different. You got five guys in the clubhouse after the game trying to get a story. You go to New York, you got 105 guys in there trying to get something. So it was really, really different. But I'm very thankful because I got a chance to be an everyday player. And, you know, I'm very blessed by that.
That was certainly the great news for you about that trade, is that you were able to get an everyday opportunity there with the Mets, and then in 1980 recognized with the Gold Glove. And in looking back over Gold Glove winners, sometimes that's a tough club to crack, because once a guy starts winning, sometimes he can continue to win and almost wins by default. At that time, I think Manny Trio won 3 out of 4, and you won the other one. But, of course, Morgan won for several years in a row at second base. But you got that honor in 1980, and that is a great distinction to get a Gold Glove.
It is, Keith. I'm very thankful. It wasn't the best defensive year I had. I think in 79 or 78, I led the league in like 6 different categories. Fielding percentage, put outs, double plays, assists, total chances. And I didn't win it. One year, Manny and I are both puzzled because Davey Lopes won one year. And, of course, the Dodgers went to the World Series, and we're both trying to figure that one out. But he hit 30 home runs, and as you say, that's, you know, once you get up there, your name just kind of gets thrown in the pot every now and then. I finished, the guy who told me that I won also told me that I finished runner-up 3 times. So, you know, you sit there and you go, ooh, man, that would have been nice. It doesn't mean any more money. Although, after I won the first one, it did mean a little bit more money because I had it in my contract, which I didn't have to win in it because I never had an agent up until I won it. But I remember one year in Montreal, you have to have 108 games to qualify for a Gold Glove. And one year in Montreal, I had 107 games. I'm fielding 994, which means I haven't missed anything. And I'm thinking, well, if I don't win it this year, there's something goofy. Well, I never saw the 108th game at second base. The Expos moved me to shortstop for the remainder of the season.
Wow.
And I know that was all I needed was just one more game to qualify for it. But, you know, you win at least when you're in the conversation. That's all you ever want. I mean, winning the stuff is good, but when you're at least in the conversation with some guys. And so for several years there, at least I was in the conversation. I'm okay with that.
Well, congratulations on that. It was a great honor. I remember when you won it in 1980, and was glad to get to talk to you about it at that time. We talked a little bit about your managers. Of course, you mentioned Sparky and Joe Torre. Tell me about some of the others you played for and who sticks out for whatever particular reason.
Well, those two stick out, obviously, as really good ones that I really appreciated. And, you know, you had some. When I went to Montreal, they were running a bunch of people through there. Bill Burton, good man. Boy, he's got hardcore baseball. He is nothing but hardcore. That's the way he was as a player and as a manager. Buck Rogers was there a little bit. Jim Fanning was there. I don't have a lot to say about that.
Well, some are. It's going to range. Feelings are going to range wide, I think, on managers if you play for enough of them, right?
Well, they were going through a lot of changes too. Guys were figuring out when we went to Montreal. You realize that your taxes were being whatever you paid in the U.S. You were paying the same thing in Canada, so you were really getting hammered. And a lot of guys were figuring that out and starting to say, you know, we're going to move and get out of here so we can go make what. Bill Gullickson told me one time when he got traded to Cincinnati, he said, I didn't know I was making that much money. Because, I mean, they eat you alive. And so they started making a few changes, and then, of course, it didn't last too long. Right shortly thereafter, they started looking to get out of Canada altogether. There's a group that wants to go back up there. It's going to be hard to get players to go, in my opinion, unless they've changed a lot of the tax laws.
Yeah, they had, of course, they played in Olympic Stadium there, and I would assume there would have to be eventually a new baseball facility if that were to happen at all. But what do you recall? When you mentioned your experience in Montreal, what stands out? I think about those ball clubs, and you had some good, very good young talent then, but it hadn't quite developed as yet. But what do you recall about the Montreal years?
Well, when I got over there in 82, I was the sixth or seventh second baseman that they had tried. They even had Tim Raines in there trying it and a few others. So I was the sixth. And for the last 2 months of the season, Chris Fire and I led the league in double play. So we thought, you know, that's going to be good. Well, they end up bringing up some young studs that were supposed to be the future of the club. And Chris and I started seeing less and less time. But in those days, the Olympic Stadium did not have a dome on it. So you had a big old stadium, and but you were playing, and it was cold. That's what I remember, it being so cold when you opened the season up there. Also, things I remember are playing and nothing going on in a baseball game and then the crowd going crazy because they had their radios listening to the hockey game.
The Canadiens, right.
Uh-huh. Yeah, the Canadiens, of course, they were so good. I went to my first and only hockey game there and saw them play the Rangers. And, man, it's crazy. But they love that. But it was, you know, I played with some really good people. Al Oliver, who I think should be a Hall of Famer. Steve Rogers, one of the best pitchers of his era. Gary Carter, who in the Hall of Fame. Andre Dawson in the Hall of Fame. Tim Raines. Terry Francona, who will probably end up being a Hall of Fame manager, was there. Tim Wallach. Chris Spire. Just so many, you know. Scott Sanderson, who became one of my dearest friends that we lost last year. But just really, David Palmer, Charlie Lee, there's so many really good people that I got to meet and play with in Montreal. And I'll remember that a lot more than I will, you know, our baseballing. And I just remember it was cold and a lot of changes were going on. People were kind of really into their hockey. And, you know, it's a beautiful place to go visit if anybody. And they got great fishing up there, too. So. You know, there was a lot of positives. Unfortunately, I wasn't fishing too much at that time.
Now, the relationships, as you mentioned, you know, of course, those start even in the minor leagues. And having worked with the Legends for several years, you know, you see guys come up, and a few go on to big league baseball. Many don't, but they all form, it seems like, some good friendships that are going to last a long time. And that's true as you even progress, even as you become a major league veteran, I would think, because when people have to be away from the game because of injury or illness or something like that, they miss the competition. But a lot of them will say they just miss the things like being around the batting cage before the game, things that help you, you know, further establish those relationships and the friendships that you make. And that becomes a really important part of your life, doesn't it?
Oh, it's a huge part of it. And, you know, when you're playing for your teammate, you're going to play so hard. I mean, the name on the jersey, you're going to play hard for that. But when you're playing for a teammate and you don't want to let them down, and you're going to bust your rear end to make them look good on every time you're out on the field. There's something special about that. And, you know, I still am blessed to call so many people on the phone now. We all will talk a little bit. Matter of fact, my roommate for 3 years in the minor leagues was a guy named Greg Sinatra. And Greg is in Tennessee now, and he and I have been corresponding lately. We're going to make it a point to hook up as soon as they allow us to do that. We're going to go visit and see him. I've been married all these years, 38 years. He's been married to the girl that I met Susan back when we were in Class A ball, and they got married. They're still together. So, yeah, it's pretty special. And, you know, it's amazing, Keith, because you saw it a lot being around the Legends, too. There's only a handful of guys that start off in A ball that are even going to get an opportunity to make it. I think someone told me 3% of everybody who signs a pro contract make it to the big league.
Yeah.
And 3% of that ever stay longer than 3 years. So, you know, a lot of guys just go up and down. And, shoot, I saw so many guys that were talented that never, ever made it. And you wonder, why was I fortunate enough to get that? Because there was some great – shoot, just growing up here in Lexington, Kentucky, there were – I never made an all-city team, and there's a good reason for that. There were some good players there in this town. And a lot of them either went to college or got married or, you know, just lost interest in it or whatever. But so, yeah, when I look back at the 14-year career out of pro baseball, I wasn't the last one to think of. There's a lot of people going, you got to be kidding me. I had guys come up all the time. I played against you in high school. Yeah. I went to Clark County, or I went to whatever. I struck you out. Yeah, you probably did.
Yeah, well, it's hard to get there and hard to stay there. And 11 years, that's a wonderful accomplishment. I'm sure you've had a chance to look back and just appreciate that as the years have gone by. Now, of course, it comes to an end for everybody. And as it turned out, your last manager was your first manager. Sparky was in Detroit at that time, and that's where you finished up. And I think you've said in interviews before that you know when it's time to go. And but that still has to be there's still got to be some difficulty in there, doesn't there?
It's really hard, Keith. It, to be truthful, it was. My last year, I got released from Montreal, and I'd been home about 3 days, and the phone rang, and it was Sparky, and he said, "How you feeling?" I said, "Oh, I feel fine." I said, "Sparky, I was lucky to, you know, stay around that long." He said, "Well, it may not be finished. You want to come finish up the rest of the year with us?" And it was about 2 months left in the season, and I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Are you healthy?" I said, "Absolutely." He said, "All right, I'm going to fly you into Detroit tonight, and we're going to check you out." "Yes, sir." So I fly up to Detroit, get my uniform on. He says, "Go out to the shortstop, take some ground balls with Trammell." So I go out with Allen, and they hit me 2 ground balls, and I grab them, throw to first base, and Sparky whistles for me. He says, "Come in." He says, "Go upstairs and sign. You're fine." And it was great. So I finished out the 85 year with them and loved it. Was at spring training in 86. My agent said, "Here's a number. They want to sign you." I was signed through 86. He said, "Would you be happy with this number to play in 1987 and 88? He said, "You're going to play short 1 day a week and second 1 day a week, and it'll give Trammell and Whitaker a chance to rest a little bit." And I said, "Absolutely." And it was a nice number. 2 days later, we went out to dinner that night. We verbally agreed to the contract. We're all good. 2 days later, I go to the ballpark, and we got a night game. Well, the team is going on the road. I look, and I'm not on the road trip, but I'm staying back to play in a night game, which I'm thinking, that's fine. We're playing against Florida Southern. I'm going to get some extra at-bats. They got a good college team, so it'll be good. I'll get some extra at-bats. So I get to the ballpark that night. I'm not in the lineup. I'm thinking, wait a minute. I look on the board. I'm the only big leaguer that's there that night. I'm thinking, all right, this ain't right. So Billy Consolo, a good friend of Sparky's, was managing. I said, "Billy, this doesn't look right. It doesn't smell right. There's something not right. If there's something you need to tell me, just talk to me straight. I'm man enough to take it." He says, "Dougie, you play third base and hit second. I'm going to change this lineup." I said, "Okay." So that night I had a base hit, and I was having a really good spring. I'd been working with Al Kaline all spring training, and he'd shown me one little thing that I'd never even thought about, and it really was making a difference. I'd got a little bit stronger. I was 180 pounds, which is 10 pounds bigger than I'd ever been in my career. And so the game's over with. The team's coming back, and I said, "I'm going to go make sure I see Sparky, because if he's going to release me or whatever, I'm going to look him right in the eye and let him do it." So he comes in, and he said, "Hey, I heard you almost hit one out of the park tonight." I said, "Yeah, almost." And he said, "That a boy?" I went, "Huh." All right, so I go home that night. My wife was at the game. She said she was crying that night because she knew that it was over. So I told her what happened. She went, "Well, I don't know." Go to the ballpark the next day. The first thing I'm going to do is go to the clubhouse guy, Jim Schmeichel. "Jim, how you doing today? All right, how you doing? I said, I'm better now. I go over, put my uniform on. The clubhouse guy looks at me and he says, Doug, Sparky wants to see you. After I got dressed, so I go in. Sparky's sitting there. He's got his head down. He won't look me in the eye. And I said, he said, this is tough. I said, Sparky, you know what? I've got a chance. You called me back up here. He says, Doug, sometimes I don't have total control and some things aren't what they seem. Which meant to say that he would like to keep me, but that's when all that collusion started. So what they were going to do, instead of paying me for 2 years at a nice price, they were going to bring up some youngster at the minimum price. And he did, they did, and he came up. He didn't stay very long. But that's when all that collusion stuff started. It cost Major League Baseball, what, $287 million, something like that. And I got a year of that back at in court. I didn't get the 2 years. But, you know, it was just that's kind of what was going on in baseball at the time. And a lot of guys after that never went back to play. But baseball certainly had to pay for it. The owners got together and said, we're not going to pay some guys. And they took the court. Baseball took it to court and found out that, you know, it was a collusion. They weren't allowed to do that. So, and then I went home. I went out the next day and caught me a 10-pound, 4-ounce largemouth bass.
There you go.
And all was right with the world.
you were able to leave it behind at that point. Well, of course, Doug, you mentioned the collusion issue, and now next year, if there is a full season next year, that's the last one under the current agreement. So those things are those issues between players and owners continue, and of course, there's always going to be some differences. But we'll hope that baseball can keep things going after next year, assuming we can deal with the virus and all of that and just get back to the regular problems of collective bargaining agreements for the long term. I was going to ask you about your work in charities. You've done so much over the years. What do you look for in a cause that makes you want to be involved? There are so many good ones out there, but what attracts you and makes you want to say, yeah, I want to give my time and effort to this one?
That's a good question. Probably the first is if there's any interest there at all. I mean, I don't have kids, but I've always had an interest in helping kids in some way. And then the other one is, and that's basically the two that I'm doing now, are military charity and kids charity. Our golf tournament should have been 40 years old this year, which has raised close to $17 million for kids here in Central Kentucky. But I also want to be involved with something where the board that's doing it is not making any money off of it. Our children's charity has a board of about 30, executive board of 11, and they're all volunteers. They all donate their time, and we're looking to put as much money as we can back into the hands of charities that are going to help kids. And I think for the years we've done that, we do it on a pretty grandiose schedule or show, as you know, with a lot of help from so many celebrities and big-time pro players, and then a community that, like Lexington, Kentucky, that's willing to give back to help out. And then the other one is military charities. And about 20 years ago, Johnny Bench and I went to a golf tournament at Camp Lejeune, and they were paying us to come down there, but yet we were raising money for a military families. And I called up Johnny one night, and I said, Johnny, I can't come down here and take money for this, so I'm going to get my check back. And he said, all right, I'll do it too. And then we started getting with our friends and start saying, you know, we need to help raise money for these charities instead of taking money away. And so I'm leaving, today's the 11th. I'm leaving on the 13th to head back to Camp Lejeune. I got to pick up Johnny at the airport, and we're going to go down for 2 or 3 days and try to raise money for what's called Hope for the Warriors. And they'll give anywhere from 89 to 93% of the money that's raised goes right back to military families. General Bob Dickerson is one of the reasons we're doing it. He was a base commander at Camp Lejeune for years. He comes up to our golf tournament here. He, along with Jerry Yanello and Robin Kelleher, started this program. She was a military wife when her husband came back from battle. There's a lot of changes going on, and ended up in a divorce, and she doesn't want to see that happen to a lot of other families. So, there's quite a bit of criteria I look for. Matter of fact, Keith, we're lucky in that at baseball fantasy camp with the Reds, we'll have a kangaroo court, and they've allowed all the money to go help this program, Hope for the Warriors, because we have 21 veterans that come to camp, not counting the police officers that are there. And these guys are so giving, and this year, with a matching gift, we're going to give over $20,000, plus what I've raised here in town with Johnny. We're going to give a lot of money back to these families. And so, yep, it's, you know, there's so many good people that are doing it. And the Bible says that those that are given much, much is expected to be given back. And that's kind of what I try to lean on. And, you know, you've been around so many people in this town that are just like that. And we're all just very fortunate to live in a town and in a country that allows us to do those kind of things.
Yes, we are. And I know there are many, many people who appreciate all that you've done over the years for your community and your state and causes beyond that, too, since your baseball playing days. I wanted to ask you about one other role that you have now, and that's the host of the Kentucky Life program on KET. You've been doing that for a little while now. That really looks like an interesting experience because you get to see other people doing what they do well. And that's always kind of fascinating to me to just be around someone who's really good at something and watch them do that. And you've had an opportunity to do a good number of shows by now. Any particular favorites, anything that stands out about that experience?
Yeah, there's quite a few that are my favorites. And I think they only selected me to, because of these velvety tones that I have. I tease. I say, you know what? I've been blessed to be around guys like you and Dick Gabriel and Buzz and Kenny Rice and Tom Hammond, and I watch, and I kind of try to steal a little bit from all of you guys that are such professionals on radio and TV. And so they called me and wanted me to, when Dave decided he was going to retire, they called me and said, would you fill in for a month until we can find somebody to do the show? And I went, sure. And Brandon Wickey, who was a producer over there, and I'd met him doing UK baseball games, and he said, yeah, I'd be glad to, Brandon. So now we've done five seasons. We're working on our sixth when this COVID thing hit. But it's so cool because being a long-time resident here, been here 69 years, and so many things I don't know about our state. Kentucky Life has allowed me to go visit, to explore, to see, and actually enjoy meeting some cool people. But I think my favorite was a Mennonite knife maker. Got to go down to Western Kentucky, and he was taking us through his facility, which was powered by pulleys and two big horses, no electricity. And to watch him get this stove going and watch these horses start working, him adjust the pulleys on every different machine or item that he was trying to work with, and to see him sit here and eyeball me a knife that, not no specs, nothing. All right, he'll look at the color to see if it's ready to go and how to turn it out of a piece of steel. This was one of the most incredible things I'd ever seen. And I asked him, I said, how'd you design this? Well, he was such an intelligent guy. He was so intelligent, but he had learned, and pretty much it was trial by error. And he makes some of the most beautiful knives that you've ever seen. And he makes steak knives for, you know, a formal, but most of them are done with antlers that he'll use for the handle or some other kind of exotic stuff. It was amazing. And, you know, I'm thankful. I hope we get back to work. We've been out of work since February, so I hope we get a chance to go back in because we have 10 or 12 shows that I know the people would love to see.
Well, there's everybody seems to be on a hiatus of one form or another right now. Yeah, I hope we can all kind of get back to what passes for normal before long, and I hope that includes some good conversations at the ballpark to see some ball games, or maybe over at UK, the beautiful new ballpark over there, and that maybe things will be back to normal before long. But Doug, in the interim, it's been great to talk with you. Thanks so much for sharing the baseball memories and other experiences as well, and we just really appreciate the time.
Keith, it's always a pleasure, and you know I'm a little shy about talking about things, but I appreciate you getting me to open up a little bit, buddy.
All right. Well, enjoyed it very much. Doug, thank you.
Thanks, Keith. See you, my friend.
Okay. See you, Doug.
You've been listening to The Sports Page with Keith Elkins, an exclusive podcast from 91.3 WUKY, produced by Alan Lytle. Our theme music is Peanut Butter and Jam by Illogical Bit, available at soundcloud.com/illogicalbit. Subscribe to The Sports Page through Google Play or at our website, wuky.org.